This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
Tomorrow it is indeed the big day. It is the midterm budget speech. It is coming at a very, very delicate time for South Africa. We do have a new finance minister because the previous one bailed out on us and decided to be a chef instead. And of course, it's now going to be the big question of what will this new minister do differently? Will he do anything differently? Does he have the money to do anything at all? And to talk us through some of those expectations and some of those anxieties, we are joined by Busi Sibeko. She's a researcher and economist from the Institute for Economic Justice. I have to hope you've got electricity wherever you are, Busi.
I do, fortunately. Thanks for having me here.
Now, of course, tomorrow is indeed the day that is keenly anticipated by a lot of stakeholders in society. One of the reasons we're looking forward to it is a simple question of what support will we have beyond March 2022, which has become the proverbial date for cutting the current system of assistance, as small as it is, in relation to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we said before that we are advocating for universal basic income grants and are calling for it to really address the long-standing gap of social protection for the 18 to 59 population. We've heard that the National Treasury has been considering a family grant, which deeply rejects fundamentally because it does not take seriously the intra-household dynamics of power, which are powered and gendered, right? And that's the first issue. The other issue is the question of feasibility. We don't have household registries in South Africa. How would you begin to define a household? We've got porous households because of the migration of labor to various cities and so forth. And so there are a number of reasons why they should not consider family grants. In fact, rather, institute the universal basic income grant to replace the SRDs.
Now, Busi, just to clarify, we currently have a grant administered at a one-on-one level, an individual level. The question that's been posed to government is how do you scale up that grant at that one-on-one level into something more permanent and something more substantive? Government has come back and said, well, instead of one-on-one, we are looking at doing it at a family unit. And that seems to be the current tension point. Am I correct?
Yes, that is the critical point of contention, because government has said, look, what we'll do is collapse the grants, right, and have one singular grant for households, which is modeled after the Bolsa Familia in Brazil, which is basically grants that are, you know, a single household. You'd have to define households, and then you'd say, depending on how many people are in this house, this is how much we'll actually allocate to all those people within that household.
So now the key question that I have to ask to you is, what difference would that make in terms of resources? And I suppose more importantly, in terms of reach, will we now find more people saying, well, actually, I don't seem to meet the definition of this household, however government defines it?
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at the Bolsa Familia itself, it's got very high levels of exclusion, right? So if you design a grant system that, you know, requires a lot of means testing, a lot of, you know, definitional, you know, criteria and so forth, it means that you exclude many. We've seen that with the SRD, that even though it's targeted or supposed to benefit large numbers of unemployed going to beyond 9 million, what's happened is that you're not having all those people access the grants. And so it's similar with the Bolsa Familia. It's got an exclusion rate of 44 to 51%. And so in the South African context, again, it's that issue of, you know, how would you define a household? Who would be excluded? And many would be excluded, right? Because then you're pooling together how much money does each individual person have in a household as a means test, right? So there's some people in a household who live in a household that has money, but it doesn't mean a Busi in that household has money, right? It's all about that intra-household distribution. My mother and father might have money, but I might not have any money at all. That's the critical issue here.
The other problem, of course, whenever people speak of a means test, it's simply a question of the means to afford something within that environment that you're in. I imagine somebody has to acknowledge that some areas have got a much higher cost of living than others. Does that make the idea of trying to administer a means test a bit too complicated?
I mean, it's not really that complicated, but I think a critical issue of, I mean, in South Africa, the means testing is based on if you make over 4,600 rand a month as a caregiver, you do not have access to, you know, the child grant, for example. But of course, again, the question is, what is the difference between somebody who earns 4,600 and 4,590? You know, are we saying that there are differences between those two people? Because fundamentally, you know, they're similar. 10 rand difference, one gets included and the other isn't. You know, and also the problem with means testing in South Africa has been that for the SRD grants, if you received any money into your account, you were excluded, right? And people get some money from places. Maybe it's not even their money, you know? So then they get excluded from programs that are supposed to be benefiting them. And so it's another exclusionary mechanism if not designed appropriately.
A very, very important consideration there. And of course, I suppose the question of the reach is an important one. Do we have an idea of how many people have been able to benefit from the SRD grant in particular?
Yes, we know that for the SRD, there's been over 6 billion recipients of this grant. And again, it's that question of, you know, even though there are people accessing the fund, there are people who haven't received their money for various reasons. I don't know if you saw the article about people lining up at post offices for days and not getting their money, right? So there's a lot of issues around the access to the money itself and post office saying we can't help you with applications and whatnot. And also there's problems of people being unfairly excluded. You know, that question I was saying earlier around, you know, do you have money flowing into your account and therefore you're excluded on that basis?
Very important considerations there. There's also the big problem that government will argue, and we know they've been doing this for many years, that they simply don't have the resources. Is this a proposition that we can test, or do we have to take them at their word, whatever they say tomorrow?
There are multiple things here. The first one is that, you know, government has been saying that we've got high levels of debt, and the way to resolve our debt problem or debt to GDP ratio problem is to achieve a surplus. So to cut spend so that you can deal with debt. But that is not the only way which you can deal with debt, right? The other way is to attack the denominator, which is growth, right? To ensure that you've got macroeconomic policies that are igniting growth, which we haven't done too well in. And the third one is, of course, monetary policy. And we have to ask ourselves in South Africa, why is our cost of borrowing so high? You know, fundamentally, why does it cost so much for government to borrow from citizens, because the yields are so good, you know, and who do the yields benefit? The wealthy. Those are the people who are buying the bonds and so forth. So I think it's a choice. Not having the resources as a state is a choice, because the national budget is not like a household budget. And I think it is the obligation of the state to maximize its domestic resources by any means necessary in terms of policy that do not disproportionately harm, you know, the poor, which is what's happening right now. We're saying that we're going to be reducing investments in health and education and so forth to address this debt question. But the question is, you know, at what cost? What is the human cost to what we're trying to achieve? Then you have a surplus, and then what? You know, what does that, in terms of the cost relative to the people, what does that achieve? So I think our states really, we have to hold them to account, that they are responsible as a state to ensure that the resources are there and to make the, you know, to rethink economics, because it will not be possible if we're not rethinking the macroeconomic framework itself.
On the growth dimension, I suppose the reason we don't have it is because government in its current form, in its current formulation, quite simply hasn't identified how to make it happen. Any recommendations from an IEJ perspective on what government can possibly look at differently, or perhaps with greater sense of attention in order to stimulate that denominator you mentioned?
Absolutely. We've been writing about this for many years, and I think one of the fundamental things we've critiqued was the rescue measures themselves, and we strongly believe that there cannot be a recovery without rescue. And for some reason, in the last year or so, our government has decided that we are now in recovery phase. We're not. The pandemic is still ongoing, and there's a possibility of a fourth wave in December. So as a government, the question is, how flexible are they to implement the emergency measures needed to keep, you know, our economy, socioeconomic spheres afloat, you know, was one of the critical things. When we assessed the 500 billion that was announced last year, in July, we found that only 202 billion had been implemented. So there's been a failure to adequately rescue the economy. And then you need a stimulus for recovery, right? We can't say we are serious about job creation, announce 100 billion in the, you know, package last year, but only implement less than 20% of that, right? That is not being serious about job creation and protection. We have to utilize the full 100 billion, right? Mm. And also rescuing SMMEs and sectors, the ECD sector, you know, how little money has been allocated to that sector to survive. And of course, this has direct bearings on unpaid care work, particularly Black women's unpaid care work, which has ramifications for labor market participation and so forth. And I can go on and on about this. But just to say that we need a fiscal stimulus that really says, where are we trying to go in the future as South Africa? And what kind of economy are we trying to have? And where do we need to invest? And government will have to do that. You know, they have to walk the talk. They can't sit back and hope that an enabling business environment will mean that business will invest.
Yeah.
Right. They have to show them that we are willing to put money into the sector. We are willing to structurally transform South Africa. And that's not just about enabling business, it's about making the appropriate investments to ensure that the economy itself is changing.
There's definitely going to be something that is cut because budgets are all about reprioritization. What are the couple of areas that should definitely not be earmarked for cuts? Because if government had to be left to their own devices, I assume they'd cut everything except their own salaries.
That's a good one. I think so too. You know, we've had this problem in the past, which is government. What has been happening is that government increases in nominal terms certain areas, you know, education, health and so forth. But what has actually been happening is that in real terms, these amounts are not increasing. You know, so there's been deep underinvestments in education, health. Social grants, even in the last year, have increased below inflation. And so, you know, this is how slyly they've been cutting the budget, you know, to say it's not austerity and so forth, is that, they, you know, it's budget deficit or budget service, debt servicing costs have been the fastest growing item on the budget itself. And so it'll be interesting to see where they reprioritize. But as we know, like, everything is up for grabs because, you know, the fact that they've been systematically underinvesting in education and health, which are fundamental, says a lot about, you know, what are the principles guiding expenditure cuts themselves. There's been deep underinvestment in infrastructure in particular in these sectors, even though we know that children still go to use pit latrines in schools, die in pit latrines in schools, and that, you know, we're in a health pandemic and we don't have the adequate infrastructure to respond to it. And of course, when these things fail, it is women's unpaid care work that subsidizes the failure of the state. And so because women's work is considered limitless, you know, and free, it means that governments generally are willing to cut where they know that the shocks will be absorbed by households, particularly women.
Yeah, and I think it's definitely the most keenly anticipated budget from so many variables and so many dimensions, because whatever is signed into law in relation to tomorrow's budget will probably bind us for a few more years to come. And if we get it wrong tomorrow, it may take some time to unravel it all. Thank you very much to Busi Sibeko. She's an economist from the Institute for Economic Justice, giving us some insights onto what could be happening in tomorrow's budget speech. It starts at 2 p.m. promptly. Assuming, of course, you're fortunate enough to have electricity, you can watch it from television, but despair not. If you do not have access to electricity at that point in time, we'll cover it for you live here on Power 987. And then from that point onwards, we'll be looking at some of the highlights and some of the snippets. And then tomorrow evening, we'll have a special focus on what emerges from tomorrow's budget speech. Am I expecting anything interesting to emerge? Well, I think for me, the one question I want to know is, what will the government do beyond March 2022? Is the question more important today than it was last week? Yes. Think about it. The government has got about 18 months before the 2024 general election, whether they can have the audacity to then cut the support system that's been extended to millions of people in the past 18 months is something that I just do not see happening. So something will materialize, whether it's 350 rand or something beyond that, something will emerge tomorrow. Have a wonderful evening. See you tomorrow at 6.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.